in today's episode.
Like, it sounds like a really silly question, but like, how the hell did you buy a mountain, by the way? Like,
there was an opportunity to buy it. It was for sale, and we actually went to our community to help buy it. And you know, I part of my the message I like to share is that you don't need venture capital. You can bootstrap almost anything, and that allows you to just have a much longer term outlook and enjoy your life a bit more in the process, and not be, you know, indentured, kind of an indentured servant to growth at all costs. And so with our desire was to have the community, you know, at both locally and the Summit community, like, you know, have as much control over the project as possible long term. And so we actually we got the mountain under contract, and then we hosted events here at the mountain before we owned it. In the valley below, we rented a lake house, and we brought about 1,000 people here over a handful of weekends, and basically said, hey, this is what we're doing. If you want to get to be a part of this, you can buy a home lot. And if you put up the money now, once we sell our 250th home lot, you'll get your money back.
This is Bilal Zaidi, your host. Today's episode is with a guy called Ryan Beagleman. Fascinating guy. I really love this conversation with him. He's a co-founder of a company called Summit. They've been described as TED meets Burning Man and Davos of Gen Y by Forbes. They've hosted these incredible events with thousands of people like Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, Jessica Alba, but even beyond that, astronauts, artists, all sorts of creators. And with the help of that community, they acquired a mountain called Powder Mountain. Ryan also bought into BizNow Media, became the CEO, and eventually sold that for $50 million, all without venture capital. This conversation is centered around holistic entrepreneurship. The first part is really about his approach, how he's been able to bootstrap his way through real estate, building and buying businesses. In the second part, which starts at around the 50-minute mark, we explore some ideas at the intersection of business, philosophy, and mindfulness. We'll get straight into the show after this short message from our sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by InstaSleep Mint Melts, the drug-free, convenient sleep aid that melts in your mouth. They were invented by the physician called Dr. Lee during his medical residency, where he saw the need for an effective sleep aid that didn't contain harmful chemicals, cause addiction, or leave him feeling groggy in the morning. I've used them myself for long flights and for sorting out my sleeping pattern after a trip. They taste like mints and are really convenient since they melt in your mouth. InstaSleep Mint Melts are now available at Target, Amazon, or directly on their site at instasleep.co.
Ryan, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, so look, man, we had a call last week. I'd heard you on another podcast. Shout out to My First Million, Sam Parr, Sean Puri. They've got a great podcast. People should check it out. You did a great job on there, and I was like, man, this guy's got such a unique experience. And you had so many cool things to share. And then we basically jumped on a phone call, and we could have talked for 3 hours, it feels like. I can't even remember how long we went on for, but it was great to connect. And I thought, well, we should bring you on the show and share a little bit of your story. But really, it was more about exploring these different ideas that you've been exploring yourself, and sharing that out with the audience. So yeah, I mean, it would be great just to set the stage, like, who are you, what's your background, and why did I reach out to you in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, I've had this kind of crazy journey the last 12 years. I'd worked in private equity at the Carlyle Group. And then after that, I essentially bought a piece of this company called BizNow, which was became the largest commercial real estate newsletter and events business in North America and the United Kingdom in 2008. Installed myself as CEO of that business and ran that company for 7.5 years and sold it to a private equity firm. Built it up to about $7 million of profitability. And at the same time, while going on that journey over those 7.5 years, I also co-founded Summit or Summit Series with my partners, and which is this kind of like community for everyone from founders of companies to nonprofit leaders to academics and scientists, even astronauts, and really pro athletes, anybody who is a leader in some sort of space. And we built that community to tens of thousands of people, and they would come to these 3-day super immersive kind of festivals that, you know, some people have said are kind of like TED meets Burning Man. And we've been doing that for 12 years. And in 2012, we bought the largest ski resort in the United States.
I was going to ask you about that. You bought a mountain, which is crazy. So yeah, could you share like what was that about and how did that even come about?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, to share it in the form of a story, perhaps, you know, in 2013, we bought a 10,000 acre, 7-lift, you know, 4-restaurant ski resort. It was actually the first chairlift in the state of Utah. And it was this pretty crazy, ambitious project that we've been working on. And I'm actually there now. I'm at Powder Mountain right now. And there's this amazing community here of people who, you know, wanted to come together and, you know, raise their children here and build this beautiful community.
So people are like living there full time. Was that the case before you guys bought it, or was that just after you've like, have you redeveloped it? Or
yeah, no, it's this wonderful place that you know, farmers have been here for originally, and then all kinds of people from around the world have come here to make this like a second home kind of, or primary residence for people who love skiing or love the outdoors. It's kind of like this hidden gem about an hour north of Salt Lake City Airport. And we learned in 2012 that the mountain was in some financial trouble and was for sale. Mm. And so today, on top of the mountain, we've been building a community. There's now about 50 homes out of the ground of people who have bought a piece of land from us. And we built roads and a membership club and lodges and restaurants and programming with talks and music and, you know, a speakeasy and all kinds of crazy stuff here. And people are coming here and building a home and being immersed in nature. I mean, it's really, when you're at the top of the mountain, I mean, below the mountain in the valley is a town called Eden, Utah. It doesn't even have a traffic light. I mean, this is a very small kind of rural town.
That's hilarious. I love that.
I mean, a story that I'll share is, you know, probably one of the most surreal moments of the journey of Summit for me personally is in 2013, we decided to host this event here called Summit Outside. We had just finished buying the mountain and we wanted to show our community, the Summit community that we've been gathering since 2008, this beautiful place. We wanted to get them immersed in nature and see what we were so excited about. And so in the middle of the summer atop this mountain, we decided to put up 1,000 tents and host this kind of like outdoor 3-day experience of talks and wellness and art installations and food and community. And so it's, you know, the night before the event started, we've been working on it for months. And there were so many things that we didn't know how to do. I mean, we had to build this entire event completely off the grid, you know, with no running water, no running toilets, and feed, you know, over 1,000 people and give them shelter and stages. And I mean, everything just like in the middle of nature. And so the night before, I was like, one of my favorite moments of this experience, like my co-founders and I had rented an ATV so that we could get around the event, which in itself was really cool because as a kid, I used to love go-karts and it was just awesome just to have this little four-wheeler. And it was pitch dark around midnight and we decided it was time to go around and just double check one last time on the site and see what was ready for the next morning. And so there's this moment where we're just driving along this ridge at 9,000 feet. And from up there, you can see 4 states. I've never seen anything like it. You can see the state of Utah, Wyoming, Nevada, and Idaho. And we're looking out at this incredible scene of this super pitch dark valley below. And in the distance, you can see the Great Salt Lake, which because of all the salt kind of glimmers with the moon. And I just remember this moment. It gets, you know, it's kind of like an upper alpine desert here. So it gets kind of cold at night and then hot during the day. And so it was kind of this like chilly air and we're cruising along on this ridge in the pitch dark. And we were with this friend of ours who decided to start smoking weed at that moment.
And, as you do, yeah.
And so, the air was kind of dank with that smell. and you've got that kind of brrr, you know, sound of the engine going, and you, all you can kind of see is what's in the light in front of you. And as we came along the ridge to come see the site, we came across all these cool things. We made all these kind of like Easter eggs, these kind of like hidden treasures along the campus. And so as we entered the campus, there was this huge man-made nest that we had this artist construct, you know, like a bird's nest. And as we went a little bit further, we came across the speakeasy we had had built out of the shipping pallets that were used to deliver the food, and where we would have comedians and like late night music and jazz. And we went a little further deep into the forest, and we came across, we had about 1,000 LED strings hanging in the forest to light up this kind of dark, deep forest area, where we would have a dance floor and dancing and music in the middle of the night. And as we went a little further, we had sunken a bus into the ground that was concealing a Korean noodle bar. And I just remember being so excited for people to come and see all these incredible little treasures that we'd hidden throughout.
Like, it sounds like a really silly question, but like, how the hell did you buy a mountain, by the way? Like,
there was an opportunity to buy it. It was for sale. And we actually went to our community to help buy it. And, you know, the message I like to share is that you don't need venture capital. You can bootstrap almost anything. And that allows you to just have a much longer term outlook and enjoy your life a bit more in the process, and not be, you know, an indentured servant to growth at all costs. And so with, our desire was to have the community, you know, at both locally and the Summit community, like, you know, have as much control over the project as possible long term. And so we actually we got the mountain under contract, and then we hosted events here at the mountain before we owned it, in the valley below. We rented a lake house, and we brought about 1,000 people here over a handful of weekends, and basically said, hey, this is what we're doing. If you want to get to be a part of this, you can buy a home lot. And if you put up the money now, once we sell our 250th home lot, you'll get your money back. And you'll still have to spend the money to build your home, but you'll end up getting the real estate for free. And you'll help make this beautiful vision come true. And so, you know, there were about 50 people who said, you know, they would do this. And so about 50 families. And it was just this, so collectively, those 50 people put up about $50 million to buy these home lots. And so those are some of the first people who now have a home on top of the mountain.
Man, I love that so much. It's like you guys, like you had this idea, but you pre-sold it before you even had to put your own money down, I guess. And obviously that's a testament to the relationships you guys had built over the years. It's not just overnight that you can just call out 50 people that are willing to put down $1 million, I'm sure. But that's really cool. And I think there's some lessons we can take from that a little bit later. We're not going to go through your whole life story, but just so people understand the kind of scale of those two main businesses. I know you've done a few different things. You know, whatever you're able to share in terms of revenue or size would be useful there.
Yeah, I mean, BizNow is really the thing, one of the things I'm most proud of, because we managed with a very small amount of money that I'd, you know, that me and my partners had saved to basically buy into this company that Mark BizNow had originally founded, and his son had joined him as an early co-founder. And Elliot, the son, and I, and Mark, we scaled that company to about $7 million in profit, a little over $20 million in revenue over 7.5 years, and sold it to a private equity firm. And Summit, before COVID, was doing about $20 million in revenue. And, you know, kind of, as you mentioned, was never really optimized as much for profit. It's always been more of this kind of like incredible fun journey that's been really meaningful to us and the community we built. And then Powder Mountain, we've sold about $150 million worth of real estate at Powder Mountain, but also I don't want to mislead anybody that also is a very expensive, capital intensive project. And so all the money has just been reinvested into continuing to build out, you know, infrastructure and things. We built a $30 million venture fund in a joint venture with some other guys who ran a hedge fund. And I've done a bunch of real estate investing along the way. And And I'm actually next week helping a friend close on buying a company that I've been working on for the last three, four months, a small business, which has been really fun to work on and help raise money for, which is kind of the thing that I'm most focused on these days, which is trying to find companies of about 300,000 to 3 million in profitability to acquire, either for my own account or to do with friends and help them structure and put it together.
I love it, man. Yeah, and for regular listeners, you'll know in the last episode or two, we had another guy, another Ryan Culp, who runs Fork Equity. And we talked all about going and buying existing companies. He's bought about seven as well. And so if you're interested in that world, we will be touching on it today, but you can maybe also start with that conversation as well. That's awesome, man. And one of the things you talked about selling, I don't know if you're allowed to say the number, but it was reported in the press. So I'm just regurgitating what was already reported. I think Fortune or one of these magazines said it was sold for about 50 million. I don't know if you're allowed to confirm or deny, which is fair enough either way. But I will say you said 20 million in revenue and maybe half of that in profit. So just thinking of multiples of businesses that get sold, that sounds like a fair-ish multiple to a private equity firm.
No. I mean, you're right. It was a typical private equity deal selling, something like eight and a half times or something like that. So yeah, you have that right.
Oh, awesome. Amazing. Cool. So look, today we're going to really be focusing on this concept of holistic entrepreneurship, and which is a phrase I heard you mention, and I was quite intrigued because you hear of things like holistic health nowadays, which is my understanding of it is saying instead of just fixing something right at the end when you go to a doctor and they tell you they've got diabetes or heart disease, you're trying to think way before that with preventative care and more of a holistic approach, whether as nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress management, mental health. And to me, that's kind of my definition of holistic health. I don't know if that's actually true, but that was kind of what came to mind for me. And when you mention holistic entrepreneurship, that's kind of what I had in mind, but I'd love to get your sense of what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, I just been trying to spread this idea recently of holistic entrepreneurship, which is to me is about using the vehicle of entrepreneurship for creating real freedom, real, a form of wealth, which is not just about making money. It's about the freedom to fully express yourself. It's the freedom to earn enough to support yourself and pursue your passions and to spend more time doing things that light you up and make you enthusiastic and to give you the flexibility. If you don't want to be a commuter, to avoid commuting, if you want to raise your kids and stay at home, to raise your kids and be at home, to pursue your hobbies and to exercise your imagination, or, maybe you want to make money to send money back to your family, abroad, or whatever that is for you. I just think that, a lot of people suffer from financial insecurity and anxiety around how to create, wealth for themselves and freedom in their career. And I'm not saying that entrepreneurship is for everyone, but I think for those that do want to pursue entrepreneurship, I think a lot of them fall into the trap of pursuing venture capital, like, high growth, build a huge addressable market sort of product, build something that's like another unicorn. And most people fail to do that. And even the ones who do succeed often end up just really anxious throughout the process because they're just working so hard and they're so focused on this one outcome. And so they don't really enjoy the process. And I've had a front row seat of watching, tens of thousands of founders through Summit and BizNow experience that. And so I'm trying to, spread the message that you can bootstrap your business and you can start with a very small, if maybe not even any money, because you can pre-sell products. And if you focus on things that are capital efficient, so don't build a product that takes, millions of dollars to build. Take something that you can sell a service initially. Maybe it's consulting, trading your time for money. And then as you're doing that, building a product using the money that you're bringing in. So anyway, there's a bunch of ways to approach it, but the idea is to achieve a greater sense of freedom.
Yeah, I love that, man. And I think people who have listened to me over the last few years with this podcast and my own kind of like thoughts evolving, you'll see, not that I'm against like venture-backed startups or anything like that, but just having met so many people like yourself who have been in that world and hearing kind of the trade-offs, whether that is selling a company for $500 million and making zero because you raised too much money, or wanting to getting an offer on a company and not being able to sell it because someone blocks you when you've given your whole life up for the company. Those are just two examples on the podcast we explored. And I have really personally been veering much more to this smaller, nimble approach, and just where you've got a lot more ownership. And I feel like a lot of people, when they skim read business headlines, they'll see like we've become desensitized to what value means, right? Because you've heard of $1 billion acquisitions, and you don't, most of the time they don't say, yeah, but the founder owned 4% by the time they sold it. And sometimes it's not the case, but you know, a lot of the time your ownership stake goes so low. And a lot of the time that works out great, and it just depends on your goals. But I think for a lot of people listening to this who actually want to use entrepreneurship to create freedom, like you said, whether that's choosing the sort of work you work on or freeing up time to do fun things, this is like an emerging area that I feel like there's a lot more options than there were 10 years ago.
One is just, for me, I just asked the question, like, what do I really need to earn? And, you know, how much am I really spending the last, you know, 24 months on average per month? And what am I going to be spending, you know, in the future when maybe I have children or whatever it may be? And let me reverse engineer how to just generate just enough to earn that, as opposed to a lot of my, you know, if I was talking to my younger self, like it was all like, okay, I need to sell for this amount and build $100 million XYZ. And it's like, as I've gotten older, I realized, well, I don't really need $100 million. I need just this income. And so, and if you make the goal really bite-sized and achievable, then there's many, many options that you could take. And so a few would be, like I mentioned, for one, you can start a service business and take something you're an expert at and exchange your time for money as a consultant. But then you can build that up and hire a handful of employees to do the consulting with you. And then as you're doing that and bringing the money, you can, of course, make a product and move out of the consulting business, which has its, you know, troubles, and move it into a more of a productized business that solves a problem for the very clients that you've been consulting for. I've seen a lot of friends do that very successfully. Another thing you could do is, like I mentioned about the mountain, you can pre-sell a product. So I just spoke to a guy this past week who launched a manufactured product in the cannabis space. And I thought this was really cool. He went to some companies that needed the product, and he said, I'll sell you exclusivity in exchange for a fee up front, and you'll have the exclusivity of my product for the first year. And so that your competition won't have the benefit of having the same thing. And with the money that he got for the exclusivity fee, he then went to his manufacturer in China and had the tooling and the product created. And so he basically got, you know, the money up front to pay for that. So he didn't need any outside capital. So I love that sort of thing. And then, you know, I've also always been fascinated with real estate and worked in real estate, private equity. And I've seen a lot of friends be very successful at flipping houses, which you can do with, you know, borrowing money from a bank, and you could raise a little bit of money from friends and family for the equity portion, which can often be a very reasonable amount of money. And over time, as you build up that business, you can transition to buying income producing properties like apartments. And so there's just all these ways where you can start in one place and gradually transition to another without having to raise outside money and own a lot more of your business.
And just to go into that third option, you talked about real estate, right? And I know you've got a background in this, in the private equity space, as you mentioned. So just to differentiate between the first and the second, did you say the first was flipping? So you're buying, fixing up, and then trying to sell for a profit. And then the second approach is just keeping long term for income. Is that what you
think? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen, you know, the kind of the standard, you know, kind of life cycle I've seen is someone buys one small home in a market that's, you know, relatively inexpensive, and then they flip that. And then maybe they move to a market that's a little bit more upscale, and they buy and flip that. And so they're doing now bigger deals. And then they buy a home or two row homes, and they renovate them into four condos. And then they do an 8 condo deal, and then they do a 40 condo deal. And then as they're making the cash from those deals, little pieces of profit in each deal, they take that and they buy, you know, some townhomes and start renting them. And then they buy an apartment building. And so they gradually moved to what I would call like income producing assets, as opposed to, you know, buying and selling real estate. And of course, you can retire on income producing assets and not have to work.
If you don't mind, I'd love to go in a little bit more detail of like what that looks like tangibly. So you normally live in New York, right? Where I live too. We will hang out after this when we're back and we're allowed to see people again properly. So like I've looked at the numbers in New York specifically, and I've been interested in investing here. But when I look at the numbers personally with my amateur view, the numbers often don't seem to make sense, especially in, you know, I lived in Manhattan, I lived in Brooklyn, which are obviously really expensive markets. We'll come on to COVID in a second to see if you have an opinion on post-COVID, how real estate might be affected. But just curious, like, how are you thinking about where to invest if you're with the lens of flipping and income producing? Because New York, for example, doesn't seem like the best place for me to be doing that.
Yeah, so that's why I would start in a less expensive market. So to give you an example, there's a friend of mine who's become a very successful builder and real estate entrepreneur in DC, but he did his first homes in Baltimore, where he could buy a row home for a lot less, and he could use a combination of credit cards and bank loans for construction loans, and a small amount of money that he raised from like a handful of like local lawyers and doctors to put in the equity portion that he needed. And what's great about real estate is if you structure your deals, I don't think a lot of people really understand how joint venture waterfalls work, but they're really, really helpful and important.
Yeah, let's go into that. I'd love to, I don't know properly either, so I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the startup world like thinks about pre-money, post-money valuations, which I'm not a big fan of as much as, although they have their place. But joint venture waterfalls look something like this. We're going to buy something that costs 100 grand. I put in 10 grand, my investors put in 90. And after we each get our money back, I get my 10 back and they get their 90 back, plus an 8% return each year. So they make 8% of their money, I make 8% of my money. After that, I then get something like maybe 30% of the profits thereafter for doing all the work and taking the risk and putting in all the effort and finding the deals. My investors are just passive. They didn't have to do any of the work, but of course they created a lot of value because they gave me the money I needed. And they made a really nice return, and they still own 70% of every dollar after they get their money back and an 8% return. But I get this extra 20% for doing all this work. And so, you know, now I'm making 30% of the remaining profits. And then now for my second deal, I now have more money because I got 30% roughly of the profits of the last deal after making their return. And now maybe I only need, you know, $50,000 for the next deal because I've now got more money to put into the next deal. And so you can gradually go from, you know, having little to no savings to building up value. You're going to essentially get paid for your effort.
Thanks for explaining that. I guess since you also mentioned buying an existing company in the first of those options, like how can you apply that same principle to buying existing companies rather than real estate in this case?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably one of my favorite areas. I mean, there's a reason Warren Buffett doesn't buy real estate. Companies generally have better returns, although they can have risks too, of course. But yeah, you can buy a small business. There are businesses for sale that cost 50 grand. There are businesses that cost, you know, of course, a lot more. And you can find one that kind of fits your profile. And you can buy them with with debt. You can use the Small Business Administration, which provides, essentially provides loans. And you can buy, you know, property buy businesses with just as little as like 10% equity down. And that even that 10% of your equity you can raise from friends and family, or, you know, you can do a lot of networking and find that capital. And you can make incredible returns. I mean, frankly, even if the business doesn't even grow, you can make really nice returns if you buy it for the right price. And so it's definitely very achievable now.
If you don't mind, I'm just going to ask a very specific example just to make sure I fully understand with some numbers. But let's say we're buying $1 million business, right? And I say, okay, I'm going to put 20% down, right? And then 80% I'm going to get from debt. So I'm going to go to the bank or whoever to get 80%. But the 20% I still need myself, right? So whether that's me putting it in or me now going to investors, let's say I was going to you and I say, hey, dude, you sold your company. I think you've got enough money to invest in this with me. And I'm going to do all this work and find this for you. And together we're going to share this. Like, how would that, in that sort of scenario, do you know what the equity split you would be shooting for between the two people?
Yeah, I mean, I would use that joint venture waterfall. So let's say you have, you know, 50 grand that you're willing to invest in the deal. You raise 150 grand from your investors. So you get up to the total of 200 grand, right? And you're borrowing another 800 that adds up to a million. And after you and I each get my 50 grand back and your 150 back, then, you know, I'm going to take an extra 20 or 30% of the deal thereafter. For doing all the work and taking the risk. And so, you know, you will in this case, right? Because you came to me to invest. Yeah, you could end up owning, you know, a large, maybe half the business, despite the fact you only put in 50 grand into the business to buy a business that, you know, if you're buying a business for $1 million, you know, that business may very well be doing something like 300,000 of profit. And then you're paying interest on that.
A year, just to clarify, $300,000 a year.
Yeah, $300,000 a year. And on top of that, you could also be paying yourself a salary. You know, you would tell your investors, look, I'm going to put all my time and energy into this. So, you know, I'm going to pay myself whatever, $100,000 salary. Plus the business is spitting out 300 grand. And then you have to subtract interest expense. So I don't know if I want to, you know, bore you with all the math, but basically you can pretty quickly be making, you know, at least a couple hundred grand a year for buying a business that costs $1 million. And then if you can grow it, you can be making a lot more.
Yeah. And again, for people listening, you can go back to the other episode where we do talk for a few hours about this as well. And one caveat I will add is I've seen quite a range in the percentage splits. Of course, like any deal, it depends on who the person is, what they're bringing to the table, size of the deal, etc. I will say from traditional private equity, that kind of 20, 30% seems closer to what you would get. But I've found in like smaller deals, the split might be closer to like 50-50 or even sometimes a majority for the operator, because there might be a lot of technical skills involved. They might be programming, doing all this technical marketing. So it really just depends, but that's really helpful to actually give us a tangible example. So thanks for that. So just to move things along, we're going to go into some frameworks that I've heard you kind of discuss in the past, or we discussed in the past. And I guess, so we've talked about three ways of being able to create this sort of freedom and income. Buying a company, real estate, and the second was capital efficient companies, right? So not putting all your money down yourself or not raising money, essentially. So I guess let's say someone's listened to that and they said, okay, I'm up for doing this, but where do I start?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think generating ideas is a practice like anything. It's a muscle. So like, you know, I would keep an idea journal and I would just write down every stupid idea that, you know, comes to your mind and just get into the habit of writing down ideas and talking to lots of people about ideas. And a lot of people don't like sharing their ideas. I would also recommend share your ideas because it's just a good practice. And most of your ideas you're not going to pursue anyway. And most people aren't going to copy them anyway. So, but you know, the thing I'm doing is I'm spending a tremendous amount of time studying three things: marketing tactics, monetization methods, and markets. And so marketing tactics, what am I doing all day? I'm watching YouTube videos for the most part and listening to podcasts like this. And I'm learning, how does Facebook marketing work? How does TikTok marketing work? How does LinkedIn work? Like, how are Google AdWords work? And, you know, I'm learning about marketing copywriting and email marketing and basically learning every kind of marketing out there, because eventually you're going to have to market some sort of product. And then second, I'm studying monetization methods. I think this is super underrated. People don't think enough about the different ways to monetize. For every idea, for every audience that you have an idea for, there's you know, 20 different ways, if not more, that you could monetize your approach. And some of those ways are more capital efficient than others. Some of them would take, you know, tens of millions of dollars to create, and some of them would only take 10 grand. And then there's markets, which is basically another word for saying like audiences, like, you know, what kind of markets are out there. And so you can study. There's kind of these three columns: marketing tactics, monetization methods, and markets. And as you study those three areas, you can then start to cross-pollinate them and come up with infinite permutations of ideas.
Just to clarify, so marketing tactics, I get, you know, AdWords, SEO, email, etc. Markets, I get as well, you know, audiences, categories, niches, whatever you want to call it. Monetization methods, could you give a few more examples? Are you thinking about like subscriptions versus selling a productized service versus a course or something like that?
Right. I mean, like, say you get excited about a particular niche audience, you could sell them a piece of software. You could sell them an information product, like a data product that they need to subscribe to. You could sell them news or entertainment. You could sell them a conference. You could sell them a marketplace where they could go and, you know, trade and buy things, like their version, you know, like a little Amazon of some kind. So there's all these different methods of, you know, going after that audience and monetizing it.
Awesome. So yeah, maybe to make it more tangible for people, maybe we can try to go through an example of maybe something you've been looking at recently and how you would think through all three of those columns.
Yeah. So like, just to give you an example, I love like getting into hobbies and then using hobbies as a way to think of ideas. And so recently I got really into pickleball, which is the fastest growing sport in America, apparently.
What is that, by the way? It sounds like a shot at a bar.
Yeah, it's like a pickleback. It's just, yeah, another form of a paddle sport. Like, you know, you're just playing on this little court with wiffle balls. And so it's like, you know, kind of like a mini version of tennis. And yeah, so say you get excited about pickleball and you're like, man, there's so many people that are suddenly playing pickleball and I want to make money off of pickleball. It's my passion. So you could go to a manufacturer abroad and say, hey, I want you to build me a pickleball racket. I'm going to put my logo on that racket and I'm going to sell it on Amazon. I'm going to build a fulfillment by Amazon company, FBA company. And I'm going to put that racket up on Amazon and I'm going to work to get reviews and I'm going to let Amazon do my marketing for me. And I'm going to just manage the manufacturing and the procurement of the product, the design. I'll build a beautiful website and drive traffic to it. And I'm going to use Amazon as my source for sales. I actually just spoke to a guy who did this just a couple of years ago. This is actually a real example. He actually just sold the company to a private equity firm, I think like a year ago. So, you know, he created this pickleball company, right? Well, that's one way to go about it, right? A physical goods business. But a second way to go about it would be to say, okay, I'm going to build a pickleball subscription business. I'm going to say, you know, everybody in Utah who's obsessed with pickleball, I'm forming a league. It's $1,000 a year. We're going to have, a tournament every Saturday. And on Tuesday nights, we're going to get together and post-COVID, you know, have drinks and talk about pickleball. And boom, you know, you could start a subscription business. You know, a third thing you could do is you could start a newsletter and a podcast and a YouTube channel and be a media brand around pickleball and sell advertising to, you know, the pickleball manufacturers of the world and others who have pickleball businesses. And so there's so many different ways to approach it.
Yeah. So just to clarify, so let's just say newsletter example, or actually the second one, I think I probably prefer the community doing physical events because it's actually a sport. So it kind of makes sense to do that. So to clarify the three kind of M's you mentioned, marketing tactics, monetization, markets. So the market in this case was Utah as a location and people who are interested in this new sport, right? Was there anything else more specific you would get when defining the market there?
So yeah, the market, yeah, is Utah people who are interested in pickleball. The marketing tactics could be using Facebook advertising. You could build a YouTube channel and make just great content about coaching people on pickleball for free. And then, you know, upsell people. Hey, if you like this video, join our league. You know, we're going to be meeting on Saturdays.
And then monetization was selling the physical, you know, the yearly subscription and then the extensions from there.
Exactly. Exactly.
Great. Yeah, I love it. It's super simple and straightforward. I think that's really useful. I guess someone listening to this might think, okay, that sounds really cool and fun and it's cool that you like the sport, but is that big enough? And like, how would you think about trying to quantify if that was going to be big enough? Is that something you've done yourself?
Yeah, I mean, let's just do the math right now. I mean, if you could get 1,000 people paying $1,000 a year to join your league, just as an example, you know, that's $1 million. And, you know, for a small business like this, there's often very little expenses. I mean, you could be a solo entrepreneur, run a business like this with some freelancers. Maybe you hire one employee eventually. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you could have 50, 60, 70% margins, be making yourself $500,000 a year with 1,000 people in your league. And, you know, if you think about 1,000, even 1,000 might sound large to someone, but break it down by market. You know, maybe there's, you know, maybe there's 10 key markets in the state of Utah, and I just need to get 100 people in each of those markets to sign up for my league.
One other way I would add to that is if you were trying to quantify the number of people that like certain things, when you create Facebook ads, there's a tool, you've probably done this, but you can type in location, Utah in this case, or you can just say the whole US if you're trying to market size, and then you can type in interests. So Facebook obviously and Google obviously know so much about us, which we've seen on news, but based on your user, your behavior, the websites you look at, the accounts you follow, etc., Facebook understands that in aggregate there's 2 million people who are fans of this sport in the US. So you can actually go on to Facebook and use that tool to quantify how many people might even be in a certain location. And it kind of ties into when you actually launch, you know that there's an audience for you to actually target on Facebook from day one. So I just thought I'd add that just because that's kind of how I would do it as well as a marketer.
Yeah. And then I love to stack things, you know, so you start off with that and you start bringing in a few hundred grand and you're making some money and now you're in business and you can quit your job and get going and have some additional freedom. And then it's your choice what you want to do from there. Perhaps you want to make the manufactured pickleball racket and sell it to people in your league and build a kind of a following and then put it up on Amazon and then build a Shopify website and start selling it direct to consumer. You add, hey, for an extra, you know, 2,000 a year, we also give you, you know, coaching where you can dial into a Zoom meeting once a month and we teach you, you know, the principles of pickleball. And you make that a national product, but you start in Utah with a following. And like, so you can start to build and add all kinds of products on top of it once you start to get the initial freedom of having some income coming in.
And just one other question, since you've been looking at so many different areas in the last few months, are there any sources that you love to find these up and coming trends? I know you mentioned looking at your own hobbies and exploring hobbies so that it's an authentic experience and you find these details when you're in it yourself. But are there sources, whether that is news sources or tools or people that you follow that are talking about these things?
Yeah, well, if I could add a fourth column, I would say learn tools. There's a lot of really cool tools out there and they're getting better every day. So if you're going to launch a product on Amazon, you want to get Helium 10 and you want to use this tool that basically shows you what on how things are selling on Amazon. How many bamboo baby diapers is this person selling? How big is that? Well, you can use this software called Helium 10 that'll kind of estimate that for you. If you're looking to build, you know, a website and you want to know, you know, how many pickleball people are going to come to this website, you can use Ahrefs or SEM Rush and look at websites and get the traffic. Where's the traffic coming from? Who's linking to this website? You can go on Facebook, like you said, and kind of understand the audience size using tools on Facebook, the transparency mode on Facebook to see what ads people are running is really super cool. And free. And so, yeah, learning all these different, there's all these great little software tools and there's a million YouTube videos out there that just teach you how to use these tools for free. So I spend a lot of time, you know, learning all these little things that are out there that I can use to help me study markets.
Super cool, man. Thanks for going through that example. That's really helpful. So I think we did a good job of comprehensively discussing that idea framework. Just to switch gears a little bit, we talked about buying companies and essentially doing deals. And I know you've got an experience of doing that in the past. So I think when we discussed before, you talked about different things that you've learned about deal making and things that you need to make deals.
There's basically three things that you need to put deals together if you want to buy a company or real estate. You need capital, which is actually, I think some people will be surprised, it's really the easiest part. There's a lot of capital chasing deals. Yeah. You need human capital. This is a little bit harder finding good operators to run businesses. Either, I mean, that might just be you running it, but I've replaced myself now a handful of times with another CEO, and that is totally doable. And then finally, you need to find deals that are priced well, and that's frankly I find the hardest part. And I would say to do that, there's four ways, and there's this guy Paige Craig who has this really nice framework. He's a friend of mine, venture capitalist, and he talks about hunting, trapping, farming, and trading. So hunting is cold outreach, attending events, networking, getting on calls with people, and trying to find people who would be willing to sell their company. You can just cold email lots of people who have companies and ask them if they'd be interested in selling, get on the phone with them. Trapping is becoming known in a niche. This is something I've become pretty good at. Like, before COVID, when I really wanted to get to know a certain area, I would host events. So I would just start meeting with people for coffee through cold outreach. And once I had five or six people I'd met with, I'd say, hey, I'm going to host an event in 4 weeks. Could you bring a few people? Here's a list of people I know in the industry that I think you might know. Can you introduce me to them? I'd love to invite them. I'm going to host like a cocktail, a little event in the back of a bar, rent a room, and become the host. And it gives you a lot of, authority once you're the host of an event like that. And then you do a second and a third and a fourth until you maybe have hundreds of people gathering, and you become kind of the center of this little niche community. And then people bring you deals. And then farming is helping up and comers and just spreading goodwill, just help lots of people. And over time, it'll pay off because those people eventually, they'll bring deals back to you, especially if they understand what you're looking for. And then trading is building a community, like I mentioned earlier, and saying to people, hey, listen, why don't we trade deals? Anytime I see something that fits what you're looking for, I'll send it to you. And anytime you see something that is what I'm looking for, if you wouldn't mind, send me it. And you'd be amazed how many people are just happy to share their deal flow with you, especially since a lot of deals don't really fit the bucket that they're looking for. So that's, that's kind of a few ideas around how I go about finding and putting the other deals.
Love that. And that's really helpful. Hunting, trapping, farming, trading. So if we could just give one more example, I think you already gave a few there already, but again, kind of this area of buying companies. So let's say you have this idea for pickleball.
Right now I'm looking for info product companies. I want to buy, newsletters, communities, things like that.
So where are you looking for that? Yeah, that would be great to go into.
Yeah, I mean, for hunting, I made a huge list using Google and Reddit and different tools of people that I could cold outreach to. And I'm sending emails and LinkedIn messages to people who own businesses like that saying, hey, here's who I am. I'm interested in buying your business. If you're interested, we'd love to jump on a call with you. Trapping is becoming known in a niche. So like actually just a few weeks ago, I hosted an event on Zoom where I just got together a bunch of founders of newsletter businesses to learn from them and also let them know, hey, if you're ever interested in selling, I'm here. I would love to buy businesses like this. Farming is, at the moment I'm helping just for free, just a bunch of people who run newsletters on how to scale and build their newsletter. And so I'm just getting to know lots of people through doing that. And then they're introducing me to other people who do the same. And I let everyone know, hey, by the way, I'm looking for companies to buy, and gradually people send me things. And then trading is, I'm going to other people who are buying businesses. So like a lot of my friends want to buy software businesses. I don't want to buy software businesses. So I say to people, hey, if you ever come across an info product company, would you send it to me? And by the way, I come across software companies, and just this week alone, I've come across three that I sent to friends. And who knows? Maybe one of them will eventually send me a deal.
You also mentioned there the three different parts. You said financial capital, human capital, and fairly valued deals. So we kind of went into the deals part there. Human capital, of course, is one of the most important parts of any business. Potentially, you could argue the most important part. Whether that's hiring an employee or hiring someone to replace you, I think they're two very different things. I think the hiring someone to replace you is quite a specific thing to do. So I'd love to hear your experience of doing that, because it sounds like you've done that a few times before.
Yeah, I mean, the way I like to do it is through grooming someone from a young age, or they don't necessarily be young, but from not having a ton of experience, so that hopefully they're super coachable. So what I would do is I'd hire not one, but three people at the same time that you think could be your apprentice. Because if you hire one, there's a very high likelihood that they won't be the right one. And so I would hire at least three or four people if you can afford it. And what I would do is I'd put them through a rotational program. So I'd say, look, you're going to come in and you're going to work in every department of my business. You're going to work on marketing. You're going to work on sales. You're going to work on product. And that might happen over, you know, the course of 2 to 3 or 4 years. And I would basically do like what I'd call like knee-to-knee training again, when, you know, maybe on Zoom now. But that's like, I literally want you to see exactly what I do. You see my screen, see how I use Excel, see how I don't use my mouse too much, I use shortcuts, and see exactly how I do each part of my role each day. And you're going to replace me in my role over time. And so as I learn new things and as I do new things, I'm going to teach you everything that I'm doing. You're going to essentially be an apprentice. And you're going to take over little bits and pieces. So like maybe I'm really, really busy recruiting new employees. You're going to do the recruiting. Then maybe the second person I hired is going to help with recruiting and another one's going to help with marketing. And over time, you see which ones are really, you know, rising the fastest and are the most coachable and really taking to it. And you start giving them more and more and more responsibility and eventually step out of their way and let them make a lot of mistakes. And be, you have to be, this is the hard part, you have to be like disciplined about not over intervening as they make those mistakes.
Yeah, that's the tough part.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Would you say when you pitched those people, you said three people instead of one, which I haven't heard people say that before as well, but I'm curious to see, what is your pitch to them originally? Is your pitch to say, hey, come and be an employee? Or is it, I want you to one day replace me? Do you let them know that up front?
I don't say that up front because I don't want to like overset expectations and be disappointing people who don't make it. So instead, what I say is join a rotational program. If you really want to learn how to be an entrepreneurial sort of person, then, you know, come join our company and you're going to go like, you know, I stole this from GE. You're going to be in a rotation. So you're going to start in sales and then you're going to go to marketing, et cetera. And I find that, you know, for the right people, that's super appealing. And for someone who really wants to learn a lot of skills, the idea of not having to just be stuck in one role for, you know, the next 5 years is really appealing.
Well, listen, Matt, I think we went through, this could be a whole podcast in itself. So this is going to be a longer podcast because we're kind of spilling it into two sections. So that was the kind of hardcore business frameworks sort of stuff, idea generation. We're going to switch gears a little bit now, because what really stood out to me when me and you spoke last time is we both kind of had this, we turned into little philosophers, you know, on the phone. We were talking about the things that we've learned and the way we kind of live our lives in relation to entrepreneurship specifically. So I would love for us to kind of explore some of those ideas as well, if that's cool with you. And it comes back to the initial thing we talked about at the beginning of the episode, which is holistic entrepreneurship. So maybe we could go into a little bit more detail than we did before. Like, what is the makeup of that kind of circle, if we were thinking of it like that?
Yeah, I was really fortunate that in ninth grade, I had a teacher, Coach Hibbs, who exposed us to Plato. And when I read Plato's Allegory of the Cave, it really spoke to me because I was a really, you know, argumentative kid already, and which was something that would take me a long time, and I still haven't really recovered from fully, as my wife will tell you, and. Yeah. And so, you know, Plato's Allegory of the Cave was about questioning everything, right? And questioning all the assumptions, questioning everything that you think you know. And so basically having little arguments with yourself, like, do I really know that, you know, is my dad really a hero, you know, or is he perfect, you know, or, you know, like, what's really happening around me? And so in ninth grade, that has like had a huge impact on me. And then that led me to studying existentialism and eventually nihilism. And for a period there, I was kind of feeling like, oh man, nothing has meaning because we're just one, you know, we're just one planet of billions in this massive potential multiverse. So like, man, when you zoom out, like my life is so insignificant. I guess I could just sit here and do nothing. Like, why does anything matter? And then through that questioning, I came upon Buddhism. And Buddhism is kind of where I had just a huge, it kind of filled this gap for me that I was missing. And I loved it because, you know, it seemed like software for the brain. And, And what I mean by that is that it helped you understand, you know, where, how to better deal with the way that you're interacting with your life. It was this path and this kind of like almost scientific approach to understanding the thoughts that are arising in your mind, the feelings that are arising in your body, and how to notice them and get more skilled, more trained at staying in a place of equanimity, staying in a place where you feel, you know, more at ease and more at peace, less yearning, less wanting, less impatient, and also less argumentative. And so, once I came into that, then I kind of, from there, discovered mindfulness, which is kind of like the Western, you know, word for some of what's coming out of Buddhism. And I started trying to, you know, translate that into kind of something I could understand in my daily life. And so I changed the name from mindfulness, for myself at least, to mental fitness, maybe 15 years ago, and decided, you know, I shouldn't just be physically fit, I should be mentally fit, and I should be emotionally fit. And what that means is I should be more stable, less reactive, and more flexible. Just like my body could be, you know, stronger and more flexible, so could my mind. And so that's been probably the most rewarding place that I've put my time and energy into the last 20 years.
I do want to bring up, because I think some people listening to this hear the word Buddhism, or they hear mindfulness even, and even in 2020, which those ideas are really prevalent in the West already, coming from the East especially, but they kind of switch off, you know what I mean? And I know you've had this experience where you've talked to people and like you might even say that word and it kind of triggers them and they're like, they just switch off. And maybe it comes from people having a religious background growing up, and then they just reject religion, and then they kind of put this in the same category as that. Which is has been my experience from some of my friends. How have you dealt with that in trying to discuss that? Like, I really love the way you kind of rebranded it to mental fitness, because that is something everyone should want, right? But have you had any better luck than I have in discussing some of these concepts?
Yeah, I like to start with being annoyed, because like, who doesn't want to be a little less annoyed? I'll basically explain to people, look, I can teach you how to be less annoyed each day, and I can also teach you to be a little bit more creative. So, and in order to do that, you need to develop awareness, and you know, awareness is something you already have, right? You're already probably much more aware today than you were when you were 5 years old. And you couldn't really imagine at 5 years old, like, you know, what did your parents feel like? And what were their emotions about? You know, how did you make them feel when you were having a tantrum? Now, you know, at, you know, whatever age you may be, you probably have a little bit better sense of how other people feel. It's, you know, you have empathy. And so empathy is just, you know, it's awareness. And as you develop awareness, you can start to have more choice. Instead of being your mind using you, you can start to use your mind as a tool. And so when a thought arises and you go, oh, wow, I'm really annoyed that this flight is delayed, and you're able to take notice of that and give yourself a few seconds to process and step back and gain a little bit of choice, you can decide, oh, maybe I shouldn't be annoyed, because I'm actually going to get a chance to call a friend and catch up, or I'm going to use this as an opportunity to get some work done, or I'm going to go for a nice, you know, go get a nice stretch, and or go eat a meal. And you can turn this frustration into opportunity, which is really just about changing your perspective. But in order to make that change, you first have to be aware that you're feeling annoyed in the first place. And a lot of times, you know, much of my day, I'm just acting kind of like automatonically. I'm not really aware that, like, oh yeah, how am I feeling right now? Is there, you know, do I hear the ceiling fan on? Do I notice that, you know, my face is a little bit tight, that, you know, there's a little bit of pain in my foot from, you know, playing pickleball yesterday? And as I notice these things, I can start to take account of what's happening, and then I can make choices that I maybe wouldn't have had otherwise. So yeah, I try to help people just grasp that one concept. And then from there, as they start to see the gains and the progress that they make and the benefits that they're getting, you know, they start to get a little bit more excited about it.
Yeah, I love that. And just to share my perspective too, I think we probably, I don't know how old you are, we might be around the same age, but and I think I came across some of these concepts around 15, 16 years ago as well. And the idea that I've originally came across was from a guy who writes a blog called Zen Habits. I don't know if you've ever seen his blog, but it was one of the top 50 blogs in the world for a long time, Leo Barbosa or something. And it's exactly what it sounds. It's like super Zen, but this was me growing up in London, not having any exposure to this sort of stuff. And I stumbled across it and I was like, oh, this guy has just got this beautifully minimal website. And actually, I think if you go to zenhabits.net/breathe or something, that was one of the first ones I read. And I've gone back to that like 20 times and when I've like been stressing out and I go back. It sounds a little cheesy, to be honest, like at times when you're reading it. But if you actually just take, it sounds cheesy if you're worried about what it looks like, and you're worried that you're kind of lame and cheesy yourself. Instead, if you just say, okay, cool, let me just take it for what it is. And actually, let me just try following what he's saying, which is essentially concentrate on your breath, and you're bringing yourself back to your center. That was the first kind of concept that I came across in this world. And then at university, I had a friend who was actually Buddhist, and I was just curious, and I said, hey, I heard you meditate. Could you teach me how to meditate? And that kind of opened up a little bit for me as well, this kind of world of mindfulness. I read Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now and all that stuff. And I think there are a lot of people who still turn off when you talk about the kind of woo-woo stuff, you know, like, but I think everything you just said there is just scientifically backed by this point. And even for someone who's anti-religion or someone who doesn't even want to have any sense of spiritual conversation, this is something that can really just help you be, like you said, more aware and more in control of that kind of monkey mind, which you referred to before.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, forget the science, forget, just try to see, like, I'll give you an example. Just see if you can make your phone calls a little more fun. So we're all stuck on lots of phone calls for work all day. And like one thing I'll play with is I'll just imagine the person on the other end of the line, especially if the call is contentious, like we're doing a negotiation maybe. I'll imagine them wearing, as vividly as I can, they're wearing a banana suit and they're being shot through out of a cannon through a hoop of fire at the circus while they're talking to me. And it'll just make me smile every time I do this. And so I'll just do that on every call at some point in the call. I'll just imagine them in a funny way. I'll imagine them sitting next to a giant penguin in Antarctica. And I'm just exercising my imagination, and I'm taking myself less seriously and the call less seriously, and injecting a little bit of fun and joy into the call. And so, but in order to do that, you have to remember to do that. And in order to remember to do that, that's that you're practicing awareness. And then, you know, there's just all these things you can do as you develop that practice. And so I actually think meditation is over-indexed in this field. Like everyone learns about mind and they're like, oh, I have to sit for 20 minutes every day and do this like really hard to do thing. I'm like, no. Meditation's like useful, but like if you want to learn how to play basketball, you can just go play basketball. You don't have to like, you know, don't have to go to practice and get a coach every day. You could just like shoot around for fun. So like while you're on calls, you could play this little game. Or another one is every time you see the color red for the next 24 hours, just notice like, what are the sounds in the room? How does my body feel? And just develop that and then see, you know, and then see if maybe each time that happens, you know, maybe day two, try cracking a smile every time that happens.
Yeah, that's a great point. I really agree with that statement. You said that meditation specifically is a little bit over-indexed because people, it became this big buzz, and then we had 2-3 apps that are pushing it, and then we've got Tim Ferriss talking about it and all these different people. And I guess I back what you say, which is mindfulness is the overarching principle, which is about mindfulness in day-to-day life, not just for 20 minutes a day when you're trying to take a break from the world. It's like you said, like being on a phone call right now, like even when we started recording, I think I noticed you close your eyes and you took a few deep breaths, right? And I did the same just before I walked in the room. And it's just bringing you back to this reality. And I think it also helps in terms of if you ask the best basketball player or the best salesperson or someone speak in front of an audience, like there's this concept of flow, right? And being in the zone, and being in the zone comes from being in the moment most of the time. And I think that's another way to look at it. I'll add one other thing. I loved your example of seeing the color red. The other one for me that helped me was eating. Like we all eat every day, 2-3 meals a day. And just literally next time you eat, take a bite and put your fork down and just you'll notice the taste of the food changes. And like you'll eat probably a little bit slower. You enjoy it a little bit. You might see the person you're sitting with and enjoy it a little bit more. So yeah, those are kind of things I've taken into my own life and something I continue to work on. That's awesome, man. I think you kind of touched on this before, which was flexible mind, like being able to do that develops a flexible mind. So I'd love for you to share what you mean by that in a little bit more detail.
Yeah. So there's this idea of neuroplasticity, right? You want your mind to be flexible, and for many reasons. One would be in business. Maybe you're often talking with your team about, you know, choices. Should we do this or should we do that? And instead of choosing just A or B, I guarantee you there's almost always C, D, E, and F. And it could be a combination of A and B. And so you'll find lots of other solutions if you can kind of step back and take an extra moment to like see around, you know, the corner and look at other options and like, you know, not just get trapped in like the one that you first were excited by. And when it comes to, you know, as things arise, you want to have the ability to go from being, say, frustrated, impatient, jealous, angry. How quickly can you get back to being, you know, in equanimity? How quickly can you get back to feeling peaceful, fulfilled, enthusiastic, excited, happy? And the speed at which that happens, the faster you can do that, the more time obviously you'll spend in well-being. And so like, you know, someone will come in and say something frustrating to me or, you know, and I'll have a moment of, oh man, that's, you know, it's unpleasant. And then how can it take, does it take me an hour to get back to my original emotional state of being in well-being before that happened? Or does it take me, you know, 30 seconds? And so you can actually work on shortening this. And then I, you know, there's also this story of the Chinese farmer, but before I mention that, you know, if you have any comment on that too.
No, I love that. I guess I will ask one question. You talked about kind of emotions and the way you were describing it there, you didn't use the word rationality, but to me, it was almost like you have this impulse, you have this thing that happens and you're kind of intercepting it and trying to rationalize. I don't know if you would use that word, but and that's kind of how I think naturally as well. But I have kind of come into this issue with other people who might say, look, like I get it makes rational sense, but at the moment I just need to feel like this. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't use rationalize because that's not gonna work. That's not gonna work for many people a lot of the time. So the cool thing about awareness is like as you develop it, the key is to experiment. And you want to basically be a little laboratory and figure out what works for you. And it's going to be different for each person and each different moment. So I'll give you a few examples. So someone comes in and says, hey, Ryan, you're an asshole. And you're like, man, that's upsetting. I didn't think I was an asshole a second ago. And so you're frustrated or you're upset or you're angry. And so I could sit here and try to rationalize, but that might not work. So instead, what I might do is I might turn on some music and I might get into my body and a little out of my head. Maybe I even dance a little bit. For me, I might even go into the bathroom, turn off the lights and dance in the dark for a moment, you know, like if, you know, like, you know, maybe, you know, maybe someone got frustrated about something and it spilled into me. You know, my mom reminded me that how come I don't have kids yet? And I'm like, mom, I told you, you know, like I'm waiting another, you know, year or whatever. And instead of like sitting in that frustration and trying to argue or rationalize, I could go listen to music. I could go for a jog. I could sit and breathe, like you mentioned. I could try pinching myself. I could try, maybe I'm hungry. Maybe I need to just go eat a snack. And you start to notice patterns. You know, I typically get frustrated every day around 5 o'clock. I wonder if I should eat a snack at 4 o'clock tomorrow and see if the same thing happens. But that's happening because you're becoming increasingly aware and you're noticing these things. You could even keep a journal of these things. And so as you see the patterns, try lots of things to intercept the pattern and see which of those things is effective.
You mentioned a Chinese farmer. What was that?
So I love this story that philosopher Alan Watts tells. And it has to do with this idea of having a flexible mind. You know, once upon a time, there was this Chinese farmer and he lost a horse. It ran away. And his neighbors came around that evening and they said, "Oh, isn't that terrible? You lost your really valuable horse." And he said, "Maybe." And then the next day, the horse returned and it brought with it 7 other wild horses. And that night, his neighbors came around and they said, "Oh, isn't that marvelous? You know, you ended up with 7 times the value in horses." And he said, "Maybe." And then the next day, his son went out to tame one of the wild horses and was thrown from the horse and broke his leg. And the neighbors came around that evening and they said, "Oh, isn't that terrible?" And he said, "Maybe." And then the next day, the conscription officers from the Chinese army came around to recruit his son into the army. And they saw his son with the broken leg. And they said, "You know, unfortunately, we actually can't take your son." And the neighbors came around that evening and they said, "Oh, isn't that wonderful? Your son was saved from joining the army." And he said, "Maybe." And, you know, the point of the story, of course, is that nature is incredibly complex. Cause and effect, you know, what they call in Buddhism karma, is very complex. And so, you know, you want to be flexible in seeing fortune and misfortune and not overvaluing things that you appear to be fortunate either, because they could turn into misfortune. And so, you know, like in my example of the flight, you know, what might appear as misfortune, missing your flight and being stuck at the airport, could turn into you meeting the love of your life, or it could turn into you meeting a business partner or an investor, or it could just give you that opportunity to call that friend you haven't spoken to in 6 months. But the key is choosing to see to see it that way, right? Choosing the perspective that all misfortunes could be fortunes and vice versa, and practicing that, which is, you know, developing a muscle memory for in the moment, instead of being frustrated, instead saying, you know, "I'm curious. I wonder where the opportunity is here, because it must be here somewhere."
No, I love that, man. Thanks for sharing that. I feel like I kind of need to re-listen to it and just kind of like sit on it for a minute. But that was really cool. You also talked about kind of being reactive there and reacting in the moment. And when we had spoken before, you had talked about this and I didn't fully get it. So I'd love for you to clarify. You said, "Don't be the tree limbs, be the trunk." What does that mean?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed this in sports, but typically speaking, the athletes that have been number one in the world for a long periods of time, like I'm really into tennis, so like Federer, Nadal, yeah, they have incredible mental fitness. I mean, if you look at the difference between the top 4 players in tennis who have basically been the top 4 players for over a decade and, you know, the players who are 5, 6, 7, 8, I mean, there's basically no difference in their physical talent, their ability to hit a forehand and a stroke, but the difference is the mental game. And so the best players typically are less reactive. And what I mean by that is, you know, they're not overly emotional when things are going well or when things are going poorly. You know, they're not the ones breaking their racket and causing a fit who stay number one, at least not consistently. And so, you know, there's this metaphor of the tree. You want to, and I like to think of this and visualize it as in as much detail as I can when I'm in a moment. And I like to think, I want to be the trunk of the tree. I want to be the base of the tree. That part of the tree is stable. I don't want to be the limbs at the top of the tree, so that every time there's a windy storm, I'm moving around. My emotional state is all over the place. No, I'm this super calm center that's just quietly observing the storm as it goes by and appreciating its beauty. And so you can practice this in kind of moment to moment throughout your day.
That's awesome, man. So are there any other things that kind of stand out to you from the world of mindfulness that have kind of helped you in your day to day and even your work as well?
I mean, we could talk about this for hours, but I mean, there's this idea that, you know, you want to maintain a beginner's mind. And there's some wonderful literature on this, but, you know, acting humbly, asking questions, you know, being wary of becoming the expert, you know, instead you'd want to be the beginner. You want to see things as though they're brand new as they arise. And because there's usually more to whatever's arising than you think. And our mind is very good at developing shortcuts for things that it's already seen. And so, which can be very useful, of course, but can also be make it hard to see things in their full technicolor and see new opportunities and things. And so, you know, I'm regularly like rereading the same books I've read before, taking classes, trying to, you know, show up to things without all the baggage of, you know, my accomplishments and the things I already think I know, so that I can kind of see things as though I'm seeing them for the first time.
Yeah, I think you just touched on this idea of assumptions and bias, I guess, because like you mentioned, like tricks that your brain can kind of play on you. And like you said, they're probably there from thousands and thousands of years of survival, where if you heard a rumbling in the bush, it might have been a tiger, like let's say thousands of years ago. And if you heard that enough times, you'd say, oh, that's probably a tiger again. In that case, maybe the assumption is a good thing to be wary of. But if you extrapolate that to something that isn't really a tiger, it manifests itself in a way that you could be reacting in a pretty negative way, or you could be overreacting to something. Like, that's kind of how I took what you just said there. How would you actually do that in practice, though? Like, have you thought about, are there certain things that have helped you in figuring that out?
Yeah, so with assumptions, like kill businesses, they kill relationships. They can be quite dangerous. And so, I'm constantly using the awareness element that I mentioned to try to notice and examine all the assumptions embedded in a statement. So, you know, like someone said to me the other day that she has to join her family business, and I said, how do you know that? And she said, well, you know, that's just kind of what her dad has been expecting. And I was like, well, you know, first off, how do you know he's expecting? And I just started asking question after question. And by the way, what would happen if you didn't join the family business? Would the family be in ruin? Would you be cut out of the will? Would you lose the love of your family? And, you know, what I find is typically people are making lots of decisions predicated on a handful of key assumptions that they haven't really looked at all that carefully, or maybe they haven't looked at in years. And I see this every day in my businesses. People will come in and say, well, you know, we have to do X, Y, Z. And, you know, and it's usually because, oh, well, it's because, you know, don't we have to hit this sales goal? Well, yeah, maybe, but we also could cut these costs over here instead, or we could just take 2 years to get to our goal instead of 1 year. And so, you know, maybe we don't have to approach it this way. And, but you know, people get kind of trapped in these assumptions, and in organizations, assumptions get magnified, because once the boss makes an assumption, the people underneath them keep that assumption, and they make their own assumptions and hand them down to their, you know, their colleagues. And as you get down into like layer after layer, it gets to a place where, you know, it's the kind of the reason why you get these slow moving bureaucratic organizations.
So another thing you mentioned was dropping your concept of right and wrong. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the challenge of right and wrong is it's not particularly useful. It's kind of another one of these like shortcuts, but there's usually a lot more nuance and gray area and complexity to life. And so, you know, in the same way, like with the Chinese farmer, you know, is something right or wrong? Like, I think, you know, you might want to examine it more closely and think maybe, you know, is it, you know, like, because you don't want to buy into absolutes. Like, you know, you might learn as a child, you should never lie. And then, you know, my wife comes to me and she says, do I look great in this dress? And I think, you know, maybe I don't like this kind of dress. And I'm thinking, but should I share it there? No, I think you don't look good in this dress. No, of course not. You know, that would hurt her feelings. And so, you know, you need to develop, you know, contextual skill to understand like what is what is the right way? And instead of thinking about right and wrong, if you take notice through empathy of how others are affected by your actions, you'll know everything you'll need to know. You'll see, is what I'm doing causing other people harm? Is it causing them suffering? Is it causing them anxiety, jealousy, fear? Sometimes I do things that I think are right. Like I share advice with somebody and it turns out the advice was not wanted. The advice was unsolicited. This is something that's been challenging for me. You know, I'll say, you know, hey, you know, I also suffered with this, you should try this. And the person telling them that actually caused them anxiety because now they have like this like burden of this like thing they have to try to do.
That's cool, man. So I guess we talked about your journey from reading Plato at grade 9, nihilism, Buddhism, landing into this area of mindfulness and taking a lot of learnings from that. And then it sounds like from there you kind of started to dig into Stoicism too. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about that world. And are there some key lessons that you that have really stuck with you from there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm extremely curious. So once I got into mental fitness, I started wanting to learn everything I could about it. I studied cognitive behavioral therapy in the West, and of course, Buddhism and all kinds of other sects. And eventually I came upon Stoicism. You know, the Greek philosophy. And it's very similar to mindfulness, but I think it really appeals especially to business leaders because it's got this kind of like very action-oriented, very kind of practical approach. It's, you know, it feels less woo-woo. And so I think it's, and it is full of incredible, useful wisdom. And so, you know, one of the key principles to it is controlling what you can control and not trying to control what you can't control and knowing the difference. Like, because most things you can't have any, you know, control over. The weather, you know, who your parents are, you know, what resources you came into, you know, the economy, getting, you know, pandemics, you know, who saw the COVID coming, right? But what you can control is how you feel about these things, right? So there's stimuli coming into your mind from the outside world, but how you process that stimuli is entirely up to you. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that there aren't continuums to this. Some people are naturally more anxious or naturally more depressed or naturally have greater, you know, obsessive compulsive disorders. We all have, you know, different varying degrees of these different things. But to some extent, you can choose to say, you know, yeah, this, the pandemic hit. And it's, you know, it's doing a terrible thing to my business and it's making it so I can't see my parents as much as I'd like. And, but where in here is the opportunity as well? You know, where is this an opportunity to maybe to go connect with nature or just have a little more time to spend with friends? Or maybe I lose my job, but it gives me an opportunity to go pursue this passion or to find a different job that maybe better suits me. So you're basically trying to control your perspective and let go of all the things that are happening around you and trying to control them.
And I definitely subscribe to this and I try to live like this all the time. And I'll catch myself many times being like, oh, this has happened and this is crazy. And then I'll kind of take a second and be like, okay, this is out of my control. I can't deal with it. And that's the best version of it, right? Where you can actually intercept it and you can have a different perspective. But what I would say is just speaking personally, and maybe you'd feel the same, thankfully, both of us are probably in pretty good positions, right? Like in terms of like, we're hopefully financially stable-ish. We don't live in a war-torn country, though that's debatable right now soon. And, you know, like we've probably got our health, hopefully, and there's all those core things that we would ask for. I feel very thankful for a lot of those things. And what I would say is I'm trying to be honest with myself and say someone's listening to this with a terrible, really terrible situation that is just beyond the brink. You know, for them, they're like, I've just lost my job. I've just got divorced. I can't see my kids. I'm sick. You know, the crazy things that can happen to us. And I guess in practice, yeah, we can say to that person, oh, well, this is just, you need to separate what's happening to and the way you deal with it. But in that sort of situation, like, have you seen examples of where it can be really useful in that sort of world?
No, I mean, you're definitely right. And I'm always cognizant of the fact that, you know, I'm very blessed in many ways and privileged in many ways. And so it's you know, you have to be kind of careful and questioning about how you share, you know, advice, because it's hard to fully, you know, empathize with everyone out there and how this is received. But I truly believe that these principles are universal. Anybody can make use of them in their situation, no matter, you know, how bleak that situation may be or appear to be. And like I said, you don't have to use it to solve like your biggest problem. Like maybe you're suffering from terrible depression. You don't have to solve, don't think, okay, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and solve depression with stoicism. Instead, what I'm saying is you can make just incremental improvements very, very gradually. They compound over time to the way that you interact with your mind. And so, you know, you could just deal with the fact that, you know, maybe I'm just going to be a little less frustrated about small things today and control just the way my perspective is about those small things. And as you build up from these small little things that are not that frustrating, they're just a little bit frustrating, then you can kind of build up to the really, these much more significant things that you're talking about over time. And so I would start kind of small initially, in the same way that, like, you know, you don't go out and try to win like, you know, a major tournament. If you're starting to play, you know, a new sport, you start off by just trying to, you know, learn how to, like, you know, dribble the ball or, you know, hit the first shot over the net.
This is a question I don't always ask, but since we're kind of talking about it, it'd be, if you're happy to share, or if anything really comes to mind, like if I said to you kind of like the worst time or the worst phase in your life or the worst moment in your life where you were really down or anything like that, is there a time that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean,
and also if you know, if you don't want to share, it's completely cool too.
No, it's fine. I mean, definitely, I would say perhaps the first love I had breaking up with me was heart wrenching. You know, that might be an example.
And if you don't mind me digging a little bit, I don't need to know about all the details of why you broke up or whatever, but that's something that a lot of people go through, and I'm sure most people listening to this have felt that. Like, what are certain things that helped you get out of that moment, which is more useful for people listening?
I was just crying my eyes out and calling my mom all day like a baby.
Yeah, that's needed sometimes too.
There was certainly plenty of that. No, I mean, everything that we're talking about. So, you know, listening to music, going for a run, you know, basically throughout my day, even now, like I have lots of highs and lows. And certainly, you know, in that moment, in those months after that breakup, you know, I had even more extreme highs and lows. And so, you know, I'm trying to remember when I'm in my low points throughout a particular day. Because even in my worst days, I still have moments where I'm like, oh, I'm really enjoying this food, or I'm having a bit of a high. And then maybe, you know, 90% of that day, I'm feeling terribly. But I'm trying to remember, for one, that those things, they pass. All things are temporary, both good things and the mind perceives them bad. And so, you know, I remember, oh, okay, yeah, didn't yesterday I had 5 minutes of joy in the shower when I was listening to music, despite the fact that I was crying an hour before that? Well, you know, let me have some faith and that I will return to having one of those moments some point later today or tomorrow. And that I'm not going to be wallowing in this sad moment forever. And then secondly, you know, I'm also trying to, like I said, notice what is leading me to happier moments. Maybe it's when I just went for a run. Maybe it's when, you know, maybe it's when I'm better rested. So I'm going to try to get better sleep tonight. I'm going to go to bed a little earlier. And I'm trying to connect the dots to these patterns, which I'm doing that through just, you know, journaling or, you know, being more aware, and then trying to replicate those things that make me feel better and mitigate those things that make me feel worse. You know, maybe every time I look at a picture of her, I feel worse. And so I should put her pictures away. Or maybe I should give my photo album, you know, back then my physical photo album, to a friend to hold on to, you know, for 6 months. And so trying to notice the connection. Maybe every day that I talk to, you know, two new friends, I get kind of excited and inspired. And so I should talk to two new friends each day and make a list of, like, you know, 10 friends over my lifetime and call them. So it's just, you know, trying one thing I guess I'm saying too is just trying lots of new things.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that, man. And I know that's I have to keep it real and ask the tough questions sometimes. And I really appreciate you sharing that, because I know that isn't an easy thing to answer on the spot. So thanks for that. This kind of leads in perfectly to something that we discussed previously, which was kind of in the Stoicism umbrella, this concept of relationships are not for happiness. I didn't really get that. So like, I'd love for you to share what you mean by that.
Yeah, this was a huge breakthrough. You know, I'm in a 12-year relationship, and I think if you expect your relationships, your friendships, your business partnerships, your family members, your spouse, whatever it may be, your dog, your cat, if you think that that relationship is there just to serve your well-being, then you'll regularly end up being frustrated, upset, and often expressing that to the other person, which then, you know, pushes them away. And so instead, I think it's really helpful to reframe what our relationships are for and think of our relationships as being, they're simply here to serve me with opportunities to work on my mental health, to work on being more skillful at being less frustrated, more patient, more loving, more empathetic. And if you think about it as a kind of a game where this relationship is here to give me opportunity. So for example, if my roommate, you know, leaves his dirty coffee spoon out every day because every day he makes coffee, he stirs it, and then he leaves the spoon out. And I think, oh, it's so annoying that he doesn't clean up his spoon. I got to clean up his spoon. Then every day I'm practicing feeling frustrated and othering him. He's not like me. He's more dirty than me. He's less kept than me. And I'm better because I keep a better home. And instead, if I flip that and say, you know what, actually, this is here to teach me patience and empathy. I'm going to every day when I see the spoon say, oh, my roommate left me this little this little reminder to think of how lucky I am to be roommates with him and how many things he does, you know, for me. He provides me company. He provides me, you know, laughter. And in exchange, I get to clean up his spoon each day that he doesn't even need to know about. And so now I'm developing this muscle of appreciation, of gratitude, of patience. And I'm seeing this relationship now as being here to serve my virtues.
Awesome. Yeah, I love the idea of the spoon because it's like a physical trigger that we all go through in day-to-day life, which sounds stupid when you say it to someone. You're like, oh, you guys argued about a spoon, like, which is, I'm sure half the people listen to this in relationships have had some form of that. But it's not really the spoon. It's what it represents, right? It's the lack of awareness for the fact that I'm going to have to do this. And then it extrapolates to I'm always picking up the spoon for this person plus another 10 things I'm always doing. And it normally comes down to like some value exchange that isn't even for me anyway, especially like one of my kind of core values is fairness, which of course everyone believes in that, but I'm quite like extreme with it. It's something I've had to kind of work on to realize that I'm like that. And I think if you're in a relationship, you need to be able to communicate that to the other person too, to say, hey, I'm not being crazy here. There's a reason I care about this. And here's a story, obviously, once you're comfortable with that person too. But yeah, I love that, man. And just to wrap things up, because we're going to run out of time soon, though I feel like we could keep doing this and we should definitely do this again in person soon, is, again, in the world of Stoicism and mindfulness, there's this concept of like the ego and controlling the ego. And when I've read books in the past and I came across, you know, we all know what ego is, but when I went into it a little bit deeper, I realized how much it was driving me personally and drives most people. And before we kind of go into a discussion about ego, I will say my opinion is ego isn't always bad, right? Like there are parts of ego, like ego allows you to ask your wife to marry you. Ego allows you to go and ask for a raise at work. And there's different examples like that. But in most cases, ego can take over the whole show, right? So I'm curious, like, what are some thoughts you've got in that world? Because I know you had mentioned it before as well.
Yeah, well, first off, I'll say that ego is, it's the voice you hear in your mind. It's this logic-based, you know, kind of tool that, like any tool, can be very useful, like you mentioned. You can use, you know, the logical kind of intellectual voice in your head to navigate the world. You can say, okay, I've got a stroller with my baby in it, and I need to get down a set of stairs into the subway. So I'm gonna need to ask someone for help. I'm gonna have to, like, you know, navigate the stairwell. But the problem is, it's like this, through evolution, that's become essentially, it's overdeveloped. And so you'll notice that you really can't stop the voice in your mind. It's just constantly chattering away. It's like a river. It just keeps flowing and flowing. And so you're trying to be able to use it as a tool instead of having it use you, as I mentioned earlier. So instead of automatically just constantly reacting to the voice in your mind, you're trying to quiet that a bit and take notice of what it's saying and what's really occurring in the moment. And with that, you're then able to do all kinds of interesting things. You can, like I said, you can start to notice patterns. You can start to experiment. You can start to say, oh, you know, every time my voice thinks to complain, you know, my roommate left the spoon, I'm not only going to be annoyed about the spoon, I'm going to text my other roommate and say, hey, picture of the spoon. Can you believe this idiot did the spoon thing again? And, like, really what I'm saying there is, you know, we're better than him. And I'm basically inflating my sense of self, my sense of identity. And I'm essentially othering other things. I'm saying, I am me and you are you and we are not the same. And that creates disconnection and creates unhappiness ultimately. So instead of that, you know, I can take notice of, like, oh, wow, every time I have a complaint, it arises initially in the mind and then eventually ends up in me texting it to someone or saying it out loud. And instead, I'm going to catch that. And I'm going to intercept it, and I'm going to just let it, like a cloud, I'm going to let it just go by. I'm not going to interact with it. And I'm just going to, like, let it go, and I'm going to move on with my day. And as you lessen the amount of times that you complain, you'll generally feel more connected to people. You'll kind of soften and lessen your sense of self, so that you're more accepting of more kinds of people. And also just socially, people don't really like complainers. One thing I'm wearing right now is a bracelet I had custom made for myself, and it says no CC.
What's that mean? Sorry, what's no CC?
No criticisms or complaints.
Oh, okay.
Every time I criticize or complain, which, you know, happens every day, I take it off one wrist and I switch it to the other wrist. And it's just a way to kind of help me remember not to do it.
You had said when we had a call, you mentioned something about leaving a mark on humanity is a form of ego. Maybe I didn't fully get it, but what did you mean by that?
I almost, you know, it's almost a little, you know, risky to say this because people, you know, they won't agree, I imagine, but.
Risky is good. Risky is good. That means you're saying something worthwhile saying.
Look, when you hang around Silicon Valley and you hang around Silicon Alley, New York and places like that, there's a lot of people that are talking about, you know, wanting to leave an impact, you know, wanting to have an impactful life, and they want to leave an indelible, but they're really saying is they want to leave an indelible mark on humanity. And that's awesome. And, you know, I think that, you know, I hope that people are inspired to do good in the world. But it can have, also be a form of imprisoning your mind to think that, you know, I am so important and my mission is so important and my company is so important, or my nonprofit is so important that everyone has to know about it and it has to work. And if it doesn't work, if the company goes out of business or if my nonprofit can't raise enough money, then, like, all is lost and, you know, my life is for naught and I'm going to just be this, you know, depressed person. And I think a lot of people fall into this trap, especially, you know, I've managed a lot of young people and they have this kind of point of view, and the ego is very tricky. You know, it's always trying to inflate itself. It's always trying to think of itself as the center of attention, the center of the world. And it thinks whatever it's working on is the most important thing possible. And I fall into this, I make this mistake all the time. Like, you know, I'll run into friends of mine that are suffering from anxiety or depression or something. And I'm like, oh my God, I've got the solution. I've got this person you need to go talk to, this book you got to read. And they didn't even ask me for my advice. You know, I'm giving them unsolicited input. And a lot of times, you know, many people, they don't really want unsolicited, you know, input. And so, and I end up just, you know, what I really should have done is just given them a hug, you know, or made a joke to make them feel a little bit better for a moment, or just demonstrated what it looks like through my own actions, you know, to be, you know, chill or to be relaxed or to not be in a panic that my business is struggling, you know, in some ways itself. And so, that's some thoughts on this idea that, you know, if people want to leave this massive impact.
I love that. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think you just brought up something there, which was something I struggle with and I've tried to consciously get better at, is this jumping to the solve, you know, like my mom will tell me something or, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, you want to get this done? Okay, cool. This is how to do it. Blah, 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 blah. And like you said, that's not always like what they need. A lot of the time they just need support and they need someone to listen to what's going on. And a lot of the time that stuff passes as well, you know, like especially emotional stuff or things going on in people's lives. So that's something I feel like a lot of people struggle with as well. So thanks for sharing that, man. I know we're hitting time. So thanks for this, man. This was awesome. We talked about business stuff. We talked about frameworks and we went into so many tangible examples. And then we had this great discussion on all this mindfulness, holistic entrepreneurship stuff. So before we go, is there anything you wish I asked you that you didn't have a chance to talk about?
You know, I think we covered dancing in the dark in the bathroom.
Yeah.
All my close friends know that I love to do that. And so I think we covered quite a lot.
Awesome, man. Well, where can people follow you? Is there any, like, anything people can get in touch with you about?
You can subscribe at ryanbegelman.com. It's Ryan, BEGELMAN.com. And occasionally I'll send insights via email on rare occasion, or maybe I'll even host like an Ask Me Anything someday. If you have a business that's like 300,000 or profit or greater that you're interested in selling, I'm currently focused on that on the business front. So email me. If you go to ryanbegelman.com, you can find my email. And then you can follow me on Twitter as well. And I'm sometimes sharing some insights there too.
Love it, man. Well, dude, thanks so much for this. And we're definitely going to have to chill out when you come back to Brooklyn and enjoy the mountain life, man. And I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Can't wait.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.